This is Word for Word, Public Radio's national speech series from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pencava. What if America threw its prison doors open and many of the nonviolent drug offenders were just set free? What if, instead of bashing enemies in ultra-realistic video games, we took that technology and applied it to education? What if more isn't always better? Those are just a few of the big ideas showcased at this year's Aspen Ideas Festival. And today, we're going to hear what 10 speakers, including Republican Senator Arlen Specter and playwright Anna Deavere Smith, offered as their big ideas. Unlike our usual program, where one speaker can take the better part of an hour to more fully lay out his or her ideas, the speakers you'll hear today were given about 5 minutes each to make their case. In doing so, they helped kick off this year's festival, which boasted more than 150 lectures, conversations, and panel discussions, among them programs we've featured on Word for Word with Colin Powell, Bill Clinton, and Karl Rove. The Aspen Ideas Festival was held the first week in July in Aspen, Colorado, and was organized by The Atlantic Magazine and the nonpartisan Aspen Institute. And now for the opening ceremony. 10 big ideas in about 50 minutes. First up is actor Michael York, who's been on stage and screen for decades, most recently on Broadway, where he played King Arthur in a revival of Camelot.
Yes, Camelot. I just finished 190 consecutive performances, and I'm not going to belabor you with yet another rendition of I Wonder What the King Is Doing Tonight, because the king is enjoying himself tonight. But as a big idea, I thought of maybe a global idea, one that affects us all. There's a poem I love by the Chinese poet Xu Ting, a contemporary. She was born in 1952, suffered, of course, in the Cultural Revolution, but still was able to write something like this. It's called Perhaps. Perhaps these thoughts of ours will never find an audience. Perhaps the mistaken road will end in a mistake. Perhaps the lamps we light one at a time will be blown out one at a time. Perhaps the candles of our lives will gutter out without lighting a fire to warm us. Perhaps when all the tears have been shed, the earth will be more fertile. Perhaps when we sing praises to the sun, the sun will praise us in return. Perhaps these heavy burdens will strengthen our philosophy. Perhaps when we weep for those in misery, we must be silent about miseries of our own. Perhaps, because of our irresistible sense of mission, we have no choice. Thank you.
A poem by the Chinese writer Xu Ting, as delivered by the actor Michael York at the opening ceremony of the Aspen Ideas Festival on July 2nd. The next big idea comes from an entrepreneur who wants to use the power of hyper-realistic video games to enhance education.
My name is Randy Heinrichs, and I am the CEO of a new company called 2B3D. And I'm formerly from Microsoft Research, and I've been waiting to say this for a long time after 10 years. I love Apple. I love Sony. I love Linux. I love open source. What I really love is education. And what I've been, I want to tell you a story that got me to where I am today, because I want to focus on building my idea, which is why I left Microsoft and decided to do it myself. My own 11-year-old came up to me one afternoon, and he asked me, "Dad, can I go over to Ben's house to play?" And I said, "Certainly, Evan. Go ahead." And he went into his bedroom because he went to go into 3D, into a gaming environment to play with his friend in a 3D environment. It amazed me that this is where he went to go. He is playing WoW, the World of Warcraft, where he's a level 70 warrior. And I'm asking myself this question for years. I have four children, and I've been watching them play in the gaming environment for a long time. What motivates them to go in there and stay there for 40 hours a week, 70 hours a week, 80 hours? What motivates us as adults to continue to buy them Xbox, Sony PlayStations, Wiis, telephones, all of this digital equipment that is changing these children and building them into a new culture of digital natives, where all of us sitting here, as I look across the sea, are digital immigrants. What I would like to do, oh, digital immigrants, is I would like us to join together to build an interactive, serious gaming and media grid to support a high-definition learning environment for these kids. I have been watching them build in environments like Second Life and World of Warcraft, where they're not just playing games and beating people up. They are building economies. They are exchanging digital objects. They're making money. They're collaborating with people from China to India to Germany. And they are linking together as consumers and producers in a kitterati world that we know nothing of. I have thought often, why can't we take control of this environment in a mature way and go with them into the bedroom, go with them into this environment for learning, and help them build them into a 21st century digital workforce? We share a lot of commonality with these kids because we are developing social networks in these learning environments, in these digital environments. IBM, Cisco, Sun, Nissan, Adidas are all moving into the Second Life environment to build a new world of interacting with each other. Internet capacity is able to sustain this for us as we get 80 million polygons, which represents a real life experience, which we'll be able to have by the year 2014. Cable modems already are going at 5 megabits per second, and storage is doubling every 23 months. So we're going to be able to build the content for these kids in these environments. They hang out in games. Teens hang out in The Sims if they're not hanging out in MySpace. Adults are hanging out in productivity software. And scientists are hanging out in digital Linux environments. So what are they learning? 30% score increases with cognitive tutors. 12% increases by watching video. 81% in better math skills. We are bound by 3D. There's no text in nature. So what I would like to do is I would like to get these kids to be able to be new citizens of the world by combining our institutions of education with these digital institutions, and do this with a group that I am forming that's called Blue Mars, that is taking Hollywood Oscar-winning technicians and building an environment that we can put on this grid to allow ourselves to build content, to build productivity, and to build an opportunity to change the world by using these technologies to bring the world together all over from Nebraska to India to Seattle into an environment where they can work together. My son came with me today because I wanted him to learn to be away from the computer long enough to see what his dad does for a living. Thank you.
This is Word for Word from American Public Media, and we're hearing speakers at the Aspen Ideas Festival lay out their big ideas in a small amount of time. We just heard Randy Heinrichs, CEO of 2B3D, explain his vision for high-tech virtual reality classrooms. With some more thoughts on education, here's opera singer Jesse Norman.
America, God shed his grace on thee and crown thy good with brotherhood from sea to shining sea. What indeed is the big idea? I cannot claim this idea as my own, but it is surely one about which I am passionate and about which I am pleased to speak at every opportunity. And that is the necessity of the arts in our lives. The need for the arts in the education of our children. I do not mean only the home that I have found in music, but all of the arts, from the written word to the most ephemeral dance step, from the most permanent of carvings in wood or stone to a canvas so covered in ideas that it simply takes the breath away. Art brings us together as a family because it is an individual expression of the universal human experience. We have so much more in common than we acknowledge. Art comes from that part of us that is without fear, prejudice, malice, or any of the other things that we create to separate ourselves one from the other. Art makes each of us whole by insisting that we use all of our senses, our heads and our hearts, that we express with our voices, our hands, our bodies, as well as with our minds. And in this modern society, art may be the only force that invites expression from the inside out, where the pure light of the wisdom of the soul is realized. Albert Einstein said, please may I, Walter? When I examine myself and my method of thought, I come to the conclusion that the gift of fantasy has meant more to me than my talent for absorbing knowledge. The gift of fantasy has meant more to me than my talent for absorbing knowledge. Truly, do we need further proof of the benefits of creativity, of fantasy in our lives? Over the years, students of the arts have outperformed their non-arts peers in all of their subjects. Study upon study has shown this. Creativity equals self-knowledge. This knowledge can lead to wisdom, and wisdom to the understanding of others. And this understanding undoubtedly leads to tolerance. Can creativity do all this? Yes, it can. I tell you this because we are at a crucial point in our nation's history. On the one side is this wisdom of creativity. On the other is the backlash. The fervent belief that going back to basics, turning away from the individual towards uniform education, with the emphasis on the sciences and mathematics, forgetting the soul and spirit of our children, that this somehow is the answer to our deficient schools. I beg to differ. Because this backlash plays on our understandable despair that many children are indeed being left behind, but utterly, we must recognize the danger of putting aside our responsibility to offer children a bright and beautiful path of positive self-expression. When our schools and our school systems say that they must save money, the arts are the first to go. We have to say no to this. Use whatever means you have to include the arts as core content in your local and state schools' curricula. Remember your own educational experience and what made you want to learn, what made arts study fun, what made you want to be in school, the choir, the marching band, the dance group, the young and handsome art appreciation teacher. Resolve to be acquainted yourselves with the teachings of your own hearts, as I always call it, your soul's music. And imagine, if you will, the harmony this could bring to our world. Resolve to make sure today's young minds are nourished completely and that their spirits are encouraged to fly. Now that's a big idea.
Bravo. Opera virtuoso Jesse Norman speaking July 2nd at the opening ceremony of the Aspen Ideas Festival in Aspen, Colorado. We're featuring that series of 10 short speeches today on Word for Word from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Penkava. Next, we'll hear from Tu Wei Ming, professor of Chinese history and philosophy and Confucian studies at Harvard University.
I've been involved in a long and sustained effort to facilitate interreligious dialogues since the 1980s. The effort has been greatly intensified when I became a member of the UN group invited by Kofi Annan to facilitate the dialogue among civilizations in 2001. More recently, I discussed intercivilizational dialogues with the executive board of UNESCO and attended the regional conferences in Hanoi and New Delhi. I believe a necessary and profoundly significant dialogue in our century is that one between the Enlightenment mentality of the modern West and Asian spiritual traditions, such as Confucianism, Taoism, Buddhism, and Hinduism. While we cherish the core values originated from the West, such as liberty, rationality, rule of law, human rights, and dignity of the individual, we should also remind ourselves liberty without justice, rationality without sympathy, legality without civility, rights without responsibility, and individual dignity without social solidarity cannot bring about an enduring world order nurtured by richly textured culture of peace. All five core values in the Confucian tradition, humanity, rightness, civility, wisdom, and trust, are relevant as reference for universal ethics. The idea of the economic man, acutely aware of his self-interest, striving to maximize his profit in a relatively free market adjudicated by law, exemplifies universal values such as rationality, he knows his self-interest, freedom, the free market, rights, he knows that is right to profit, legality, adjudicated by law, and personal worth. But all these values put together are not sufficient to create a dialogical civilization or a global community. Other values, indispensable to human survival and flourishing, must also be cultivated, such as responsibility, justice as fairness, sympathy, indeed compassion from the Buddhist point of view, civility or decency, and communal solidarity. Dialogue, so conceived, is neither a tactic of persuasion nor a strategy of conversion, but a way of generating mutual understanding through sharing common values and creating a meaning of life together. As we approach civilizational dialogues, we need to suspend our desires to sell our ideas, to persuade others to accept our beliefs, to seek their approval of our opinions, to evaluate our course of action in order to gain agreement on what we cherish as true or to justify our deeply held convictions. Rather, the purpose is to learn what we do not know, to listen to different voices, to open ourselves up to multiple perspectives, to reflect on our own assumptions, to share insights, to discover tacit agreements, and to explore best practices for human flourishing. Thank you.
Harvard historian Tu-Wei Ming speaking as part of the opening ceremony of this year's Aspen Ideas Festival. He was one of 10 participants who were given 5 minutes each to lay out their big idea. Next, Arlen Specter, a Republican senator from Pennsylvania.
Whenever I begin a speech with a time limitation, I make it a practice to conspicuously take off my watch and place it on the podium to give the organizers and the audience a false sense of security that that I will abide by the time limits. My big idea is to organize a million-person march on the Mall of the Capitol to be within hearing distance of the White House so that the federal government will adequately fund the National Institutes of Health and permit federal funding to be used for embryonic stem cell research. So that scientists may move unencumbered to use their imagination and their ideas and their creativity to eradicate or at least alleviate cancer and heart disease and Parkinson's and scleroderma and every other known malady. Senator Tom Harkin and I on the Appropriations Subcommittee for Health have led the way to increase NIH funding from $12 to $29 billion, but recently there have been cuts. The National Cancer Institute last year was cut by $50 million. It's unacceptable in a federal budget of $2.9 trillion to have only $29 billion for NIH. Similarly, we have twice passed stem cell research legislation to authorize the use of federal funds. Twice it has been vetoed. There are 110 million Americans who were affected directly or indirectly with these maladies. And a march on the White House, a march on the Mall, really on the White House, could make a difference. In 1970, President Nixon declared war on cancer, and had we pursued that war with the same intensity we have pursued other wars, cancer would have been cured. And I wouldn't have gotten Hodgkin's last year. I've got a minute left, Walter. So I'm going to be just a little personal. A chemotherapy is a rugged process, and one of the consequences is that you lose your hair. And I was very obvious in my loss of hair because I was on TV so much with the confirmation hearings of Roberts and Alito. You practically see it fall out follicle by follicle. Suddenly there was more interest in my hairstyle than there was in my public policy positions. But this idea can be activated, and it would be a tremendous force unleashing scientific creativity on the maladies from which we suffer today. Thank you.
Actually, what I'm going to present is relevant to what the senator has just discussed. I've been studying not big ideas this year, but big personalities. And one of them is Governor Ann Richards, the late Governor Ann Richards, who died of esophageal cancer in September. of last year. And I've spent a lot of time thinking about her. You know, she actually wasn't the first woman governor of Texas. And if you know this story, this is the African-American part of the show, so please participate. When I asked her if she was the first woman governor of Texas, she said, well, no. In the 20s, there was Pa Ferguson. And he was married to Ma. And when Pa died, Ma became governor. Now, she was the one, when asked about bilingual education, who said, if the English language is good enough for Jesus Christ, it's good enough for everybody. So, what a wonderful wordsmith to spend the year with. And I went to interview Anne right before she started proton therapy for her esophageal cancer. And this is word for word from that interview. And I had the opportunity to visit the proton therapy unit of MD Anderson's Cancer Center. And it is given to a patient through a linear accelerator, which is as long as a football field. And it goes at protons go at two-thirds the speed of light to hit the body. So if you have something like that hitting your body, you have to have the spirit to match it. And so this is called chi. Well, let's talk about something else, Anna, which I think is really important to say to you. I have two choices every day when I get up. I can feel good, or I can feel bad. And a whole lot of what I feel is in my brain. So if I tell myself this is going to be a great day, and I know by now to treat one day at a time, then it's a better day. But if I tell myself, so when I get up in the morning, I say this is going to be a good day. And even when it isn't, it's better. Because I am conscious that what I think has a whole lot to do with how I feel. My daughter Ellen has managed this entire thing for me, so I don't have to use up my chi doing that. That's what it is. That's your life force. That's your life. And you have to save that to beat this physical thing that you have. I go to this woman, and she does what's called energy work with me. Isn't it wonderful? And I told her that I had a hell of a day. That a guy came up and just had to see me that day, just a friend. He needed some advice, and it couldn't wait. You know something about being indomitable. Anyway, he left. And another guy came up. And he was there. And then I had to go all the hell to the north of town to do something. And by the time I got to her, I was really whipped. And she said, Anne, you are using up your chi. Now you have to save that chi. You're giving it away to all these other people, and you can't do that now. Made an exception. I'm giving it to you tonight. It's just a natural thing I have to give everything I have. But I just can't do that. People call me up on the phone. I say, I can't talk to you right now. You're using up my chi. They put me on a regimen. I can't shake hands. I can't hug people. Made an exception with you tonight. I can't do all the things I did to be governor. It's just, I can't do it. I just say, I'm so sorry, I can't shake your hand. I'm on chemotherapy. People get too close, step back. I'd love for you to meet my oncologist. Her name is Dr. Phan. She's Vietnamese. I said, well, Dr. Phan, do you have children? She said, no, I'm married to this hospital. You're my girl. What could be better than that? And when you see her, I get so tickled. When you see her too, you're going to know she's married to the hospital. They assigned her to me. I think they kind of handpicked the doctors who work best for the patients. I don't think they have any Republicans on my team.
Playwright and actress Anna Deavere Smith and a bit of documentary theater at the Aspen Ideas Festival. Before that, we heard from Pennsylvania Republican Senator Arlen Specter. As a sort of opening ceremony, the festival organizers gave 10 speakers 5 minutes each to explain their big idea. For environmental scientist Peter Glick, that idea was thinking smaller.
I'd like to throw out the idea that less may be better. And let me tell you what I mean by that. I work on water issues. I've worked on water issues for a long time. And one of the challenges with water is that we live in a world in which people are trained from the beginning to think that more is better. More money, more GNP, more resource use, more energy use, more is better. That's the way we grow up. That's the society we live in. And in the water world, the dilemma is that there's a fixed amount of water on the planet. There's a finite amount of fresh water on the planet. And the idea that more is better ultimately runs into a contradiction because there isn't forever more water. And so part of what I've spent a lot of my time thinking about is how do we live within fixed limits with a growing population, with a growing economy, with, in theory, growing demands for more. And I'd like to expand that to the broader concept that, in fact, maybe more isn't always better. Maybe less is better. In a lot of ways, maybe less is better. And that thinking about how less might be better is going to be a difficult challenge for a lot of us. And let me talk about population as an example. There are parts of the planet, there are countries, there are regions, there are parts of the United States where population is actually decreasing. Small towns where people are leaving faster than they're moving in. Italy, where the population is going to be decreasing, is already decreasing. China, which we think of as a huge country, is a huge country, has the world's largest population. Within a decade or two, their population is going to start to go down, not to go up any longer. What does that mean for our economies? What does that mean for the way we think about resource use, for development? We do not think about these things at the moment the way I think we need to start thinking about them. Are we going to have to begin to rearrange our economies for decreasing populations, for decreasing workforces in certain age categories? What does that mean for corporations if less is perhaps better in some circumstances? What does that mean for the environment? What does that mean for our quality of life? What's the role of the internet in all of this? And just to close, to bring this back to water, it turns out that in the United States, we use less water today for everything than we used 30 years ago. We're not using more water. The fundamental assumption of water planners is population grows exponentially, our economy grows exponentially, our water demand grows exponentially. Of course, we have to build more dams. We have to tap more groundwater. We have to move water from farther and farther away. We use less water today in the United States for everything than we used 30 years ago. That's a pretty remarkable fact, poorly understood, poorly known. And it has to do with a fundamental rethinking of our economy, with what we use water for, with efficiency, how efficient we are in using our resources, with the structure of our economy. And it may be, in some ways, a good sign in this thinking that maybe less is better. Thank you.
Peter Glick of the Pacific Institute, speaking July 2nd at the Aspen Ideas Festival. Glick spoke as part of the week-long festival's opening ceremony. It was titled, What's the Big Idea? This is Word for Word from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pancava. We'll hear next from Reza Aslan, author of No God But God and an associate at the University of Southern California's Center on Public Diplomacy.
Not too long ago, as many of you know, A political party came to power in the Middle East. This party was an ideologically based party. In fact, it had its roots in terrorist organizations, widely acknowledged terrorist organizations, both from the United States and the European Union. Unfortunately, the problem with this party is that its founding manifesto, its charter, its mission statement, not only rejected the Oslo Accords, the two-state solution for the Israeli-Palestinian crisis, but it also it refused to even acknowledge the existence of a other party, that there was a second state to be had. In fact, their founding charter says quite clearly that the only possibility for the land is an unbreakable land, the total land, all of it, from beginning to end. No separation, no division, no partitioning whatsoever. However, in a very fair and free election, they came to power. And the international community, though somewhat concerned, decided to go ahead and acknowledge them, to accept their governorship, their rulership over the region, and began the process of bringing them into the fold. And an amazing thing happened. Suddenly, because of the requirements of governing, because of the opportunities that political participation brought to this ideological party, slowly but surely, they were forced to moderate their extremist tendencies. They were forced to moderate their extremist ideologies. In fact, the very necessity of realpolitik forced them to put aside their ideological concerns and instead focus on the realities of having to be responsible for an entire population of people who voted you into power, not because of what your ideology was, but because you were cleaning the streets, because you were building hospitals, because you were feeding the poor and giving shelter to the homeless. And sure enough, slowly but surely, that ideology began to take a back seat, and the party itself not just became more moderate, but actually fractured and disintegrated into a number of different parties. And suddenly, that moderation that so many were hoping would occur if given the opportunity to govern and to rule in some sense, is exactly what happened. Of course, I'm referring to the Likud party in Israel. Now, I am not about to stand here and compare Hamas to Likud. Of course not. But the point is this. We are on an irreversible course in that region, whether you like it or not. We have stated that we are going to function now based on the idea, and it's an interesting idea, that political participation has the power to moderate extremist tendencies. Now, maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. Maybe this idea of democratizing the Arab world is all a bunch of BS. We don't really mean it. It's just yet another way of, because it's a neo-colonialism, if you will. Perhaps. But if it's not, if you actually do believe it, if you actually think, in the absence of any other options, that this is the only option that is available to us, the hope that if we bring these groups into the fold, if we add their voice to the market of ideas and allow the population themselves to freely either accept or reject it, then perhaps, maybe, this is a way to moderate these kinds of tendencies. If you believe it, then you have to understand that this is going to be a long and bumpy and violent ride, and you better buckle up for it. If you don't believe it, then let's just stop talking about it as though it's actually something that we're pursuing in any serious way. Let's go back to the status quo. Let's go back to stability over democracy, because it's worked really well for us in that region so far, hasn't it? We in this country have had almost 250 years to work on this experiment called democracy. 250 years, and we're still trying to figure out what is the role of religion in the public realm. 250 years, and we're still trying to figure out how do we reconcile ethnic divisions? What do we do about the gender divides? How long did it take us to actually give the rights and privileges enshrined into our Constitution to black Americans, to female Americans? 250 years, and we're still trying to figure out how this democracy thing works. Here's my big idea. Why not give the Arab world a day before we call it a failure? Thank you.
Reza Aslan's upcoming book is How to Win the Cosmic War, Why We're Losing the War on Terror. Next up at the Aspen Ideas Festival's opening session on Big Ideas was Reverend Calvin Butts, pastor of Abyssinian Baptist Church in New York City.
I am concerned deeply that a group of Americans is fastly becoming extinct, and I am one of them. I am an African American man. Two things, among others, really concern me. One is AIDS. The epicenter of the epidemic is in the African American community, and it is particularly devastating to African American women. And two, it's the number of men, African American men, who are incarcerated in this nation's prisons. The prisons need to be opened, and large numbers of black men need to be released, especially those who have been incarcerated because of what I will call minor drug infractions. Listen, I am a Baptist preacher. When they told me 3 minutes, you know how ridiculous that sounds for me to. But listen, I have yet to understand how one psychotropic drug can be any different from any other. And my own personal experience tells me that murders, domestic violence, child abuse is more the result of alcohol consumption when it is linked to a drug than any other drug. And that all of the other drugs combined do not kill as many as alcohol and tobacco. So I am also perplexed as to why crack cocaine carries a more severe penalty than powdered cocaine. I am also perplexed as to why most of the drugs that are sold in America are not sold by black people, are not purchased by black people, but black men are in prison for drugs. I say, standing on biblical ground, it is not fine-tuned yet, that the jails ought to be opened. I will save the American taxpayer huge amounts of money. I will fight AIDS because of the men in prison having sex with men and then coming home, who are not homosexual, but coming home and then having sex with their girlfriends and wives. I am deeply concerned about it. The war on drugs is a dismal and absolute failure, except if it is the intent of it to incarcerate black men. Now, my idea, repeal prohibition. My idea, open the jailhouse doors. My idea is to help save a whole host of American citizens from the devastation of policies gone wild, and to remind all of you again that it is not justice. What's justice for you may not be justice for me. And I think it was Paul Marcus and Glaucon and a bunch of these fellows got together a long time ago and tried to talk about justice. It is not justice that will cure the distortions of human community. It is the forgiveness of sin. Thank you very much.
Calvin Butts is a Baptist minister and president of the State University of New York College at Old Westbury. He spoke July 2nd as part of the kickoff of this year's Aspen Ideas Festival in Aspen, Colorado. And finally this hour, one last big idea from Fred Kent, the founder and president of the Project for Public Spaces.
We work all over the world on creating places that nurture communities. And the big idea is one that I will explain as I go through this. I organized Earth Day in 1970 in New York City. It was a powerful experience, and there were an amazing number of people at that same time that had transformative impacts on cities, and especially New York. Central Park started to be renewed about that time. Rockefeller Center, Bryant Park, became an opportunity that eventually was fulfilled. I studied with Margaret Mead. I had Jane Jacobs was one of the first people I met when I worked with this man, William White. These are all amazing giants of people that had a transformative impact. And then we were set up to apply that work to cities all over the world. We worked in about 2,000 communities in 26 countries and 48 states. Last week I was working in Hong Kong and Durham, North Carolina, in an African-American community and in a Chinese community, around creating a place for those people. What we did, the idea of place started to become part of people's language maybe 10, 12, 15 years ago, the sense of place, the desire to have a place to gather. Placemaking has become an operative word. It defines a proactive process. It's about being involved in doing something to create a place in your community, in your neighborhood, about your assets, about who you are, show yourself to other people. It's about the assets of your people. It's a big idea. We asked people in our email list of 30,000 people what they thought placemaking was. We had amazing responses. One person said, and he quoted Thoreau, he said, "There is no value in life except what you choose to place upon it, and no happiness in any place except what you bring to it yourself." So then he said, in this light, placemaking is a dynamic human function. It is an act of liberation, of staking claim, of beautification. It is true human empowerment. That is a big idea. So when you think about the place in your neighborhood, in your community that is sacred to you, look at how it builds and supports that local economy. Think about how it nurtures and defines your community's identity. Think about how it draws a more diverse population that you become aware of by being in that place. Think about how it promotes public health, and think about how it becomes a place where you see passion, affection, and love. So there are lots of obstacles to this. Major obstacles. The biggest one is the planning departments, the transportation agencies, and designers. I'll pick on traffic engineers. Traffic engineers have done more to destroy cities all over the world than any other discipline. With their narrow focus on the automobile moving faster through a given place, our cars are getting bigger, and our children can no longer walk in our communities safely. Richard Louv, who wrote The Last Child in the Woods, or something like that, you know it probably better than I, but he said in that there was a study that 9-year-olds The amount of distance from their home that they've been allowed to go has decreased substantially in the last 30 years, so that now many of our kids are homebound in rooms now communicating with other people without connecting with them. That is not the future, we hope. So what I found when I was working on a little town in northern New England, a town called Littleton, there was this T-shirt, and it said, "Recipe for an American Renaissance. Eat in diners, ride trains, put a porch on your house, shop on Main Street, live in a walkable community." So you see what's going on is it's really about common sense. And I believe there is a kind of convergence going on. We're working with people in the health field at an amazing level now because they see that a lot of the problems in our communities are health-related, obesity, isolation, all those kinds of diseases. We're working with the preservationists because they want to now create places that we want to preserve, and many other groups. So there's a kind of convergence of all the issues that all of us are concerned about and that many of us talked about here. So my big idea is let's get back to common sense. Thank you.
Fred Kent of the Project for Public Spaces. He was one of 10 speakers at the What's the Big Idea opening session of this year's Aspen Ideas Festival in Aspen, Colorado. The week-long festival was organized by The Atlantic Magazine and the nonpartisan Aspen Institute. This hour, we heard 10 big ideas featured as the festival's opening ceremony. In addition to Fred Kent, we heard Reverend Calvin Butts, author Reza Aslan, environmental scientist Peter Glick, playwright and actress Anna Deavere Smith, Republican U.S. Senator Arlen Specter from Pennsylvania, Harvard professor Tu-Wei Ming, opera singer Jesse Norman, business executive Randy Heinrichs, and actor Michael York. We've featured a number of programs from the Ideas Festival this summer on Word for Word, including sessions with Colin Powell, Bill Clinton, and Karl Rove. You can hear those programs anytime you'd like on our website. It's wordforword.org. And while you're there, don't forget, you can subscribe to our free weekly podcast. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Word for Word for American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pencava.
Word for Word is produced by Curtis Gilbert and Larissa Anderson, with associate producer Patty Ray Rudolph. We had lots of help this week from Kyle Sisko, and the technical director is Sam Keenan. American Public Media.